I think that it's okay to be fearful of technology. It's okay to be fearful of AI. Keep an open mind, I think, and realize that this is the future. AI is moving into everything we do, whether it's going to a fast food restaurant, to filing your taxes, to healthcare, to stock trading. It's in everything, and it's made its way in other major organizations or other industries, way ahead of healthcare. So I think that being fearful is okay, and inviting people that are skeptics to the room, to the table, anytime you're implementing technology is a good thing, because you want full scale adoption from the proponents to the people that do not believe that it will work or impact anything they do. So invite the fearful people, invite the people that are skeptics, as well as the advocates. I think that remembering too that artificial intelligence is built by humans. And really, it's humans that are excelling because we're developing it, right? It's not a sentient being of any kind. Its capabilities and limitations are all human created to an extent, right? We're getting into deeper discussions on AI, but I think that also is the humanistic side is what the big focus is on. AI is mainly focused on taking away administrative capabilities, augmenting the human capability.
Well, welcome to the podcast of the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine. And today our topic is artificial intelligence and healthcare leadership. And today I'm delighted to have Christopher, and say your last name for me, Christopher.
Welchel.
Welchel. And Christopher had a career as a respiratory therapist in Colorado. And over time started to make a move into healthcare leadership, to the point where he has a master's degree in healthcare administration and is about to get his doctorate in healthcare leadership. And we're going to be talking today with Chris about leadership as it relates to artificial intelligence and medicine. So thanks for being on the podcast, Chris. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey from respiratory therapy to healthcare leader?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on today. It's a long story, but hopefully a mildly entertaining one at the same time. And I'll definitely keep it brief. But my background, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I was surrounded by physicians and lawyers. And so I felt like I only had two pathways, but kind of wanted to be my own guy. And so it took me a while to find my path. And, you know, when I was in hydraulics and pneumatics, working for an engineering company, I thought that was my pathway. And a lot of my close friends and even colleagues know that when my father suddenly passed in 1999, it kind of created a shift, a seismic shift in my career. And for some reason, I knew I wanted to help people. And that was a newfound thing. And my immediate direction change, I started looking at nursing because I was looking at nurses around me that I knew. And I thought, this looks great. And I looked at all these different professions. And respiratory therapy made sense to me. It made the most sense because of my background in hydraulics and pneumatics, pumps, flows, pressures, it all made sense. So it seemed to me that that was going to be somewhat of an easy path, if you want to call it that. And so I pursued a program and I pursued a degree in respiratory therapy and fascinated and spent many a years, I think 20 years or so, on and off at bedside and treating everybody under the sun. But I really had a passion for neonatal and pediatrics. One of the reasons I think being is the level of intensity, the level of professionalism, and really the high performing folks in healthcare had a tendency to focus on that, among other fields too. And I don't want to discredit any other fields, obviously. But I also had a fondness for the cardiac system. And so I always worked in cardiovascular ICUs as a passion, or neonatal ICUs. It was kind of this up and down push-pull dynamics that I had. Since my father passed away from MI, I always wanted to be surrounded with something around the heart, and I just loved it. So I bounced around in that for a while, and then I was asked over time to be a charge therapist and supervisors and things like that. And a lot of people said, "Well, why don't you get into management and leadership?" I was like, "Oh, I love patients too much. I love diving in and solving those problems on the fly, critical care, emergency care, traumas, and so forth." And that slowly faded over time. And what I mean is that I was attending traumas and high levels of intensity and acute care, and emergency medicine. And I was the most comfortable person in the room. At least I felt like it. I got to the point where my heart rate wouldn't change. I knew what I was doing. I felt like I was practicing at the top of scale. And so I wanted something else to kind of stimulate my day and change, or to challenge me. And so I pursued more advanced degrees. I pursued more advanced opportunities. And so here we are, some 24 odd years later. A few years ago, I broke out and started consulting because I was doing so many projects in the healthcare environment beyond my patient care responsibilities or leadership responsibilities. I was always finding these amazing opportunities that existed in healthcare to make a difference. And I thought to myself, I'm doing all these things. Why don't I break out on my own? Why don't I pursue doing this as a profession? And hence, that's the launch of my consulting. And now I get to do these things full time.
Now,
So that's the short of it.
the name of your consulting company and some of the examples of some projects that you do.
Yeah, so the primary focus of Health Talk is it's really to focus on efficiency. And that's what I found working at 20 years or so at bedside is redundancy of tasks and time-consuming things that really took people away from what they wanted to do in healthcare. And that's physicians down to clerks and everybody in between. They all got into healthcare, and we all got into healthcare to really impact the patients that we serve. And when we get burdened with administrative tasks and so forth, I really felt like there was opportunities to streamline those, to improve the efficiency of them, and kind of return, I guess, healthcare practitioners to caring for patients, or to be able to focus on that and reduce that cognitive burden that we all suffer from, with having all these administrative things going on. And so Health Talk really focuses on that. And there's nothing better than getting a call from recently a physician up in, I think, the New England area, and saying, "I've got this intake process for our patients, for this program that they have." And I won't get into too detail, but and essentially, it was very time consuming. It's taking an hour long per patient to get them checked into this whole program that they had. And as he explained it to me, and there's some published works on their design and their system and everything, and he shared that with me. He said, "Is there a way that artificial intelligence could potentially streamline this process?" And as I thought about it, and I started immediately thinking of all the different systems that are out there and technologies, I said, "How about we take that 1 hour and reduce it to 10 minutes?" And he about just, I could hear him on the other end of the phone just saying, "No way." I said, "Absolutely." I said, he said, "That's impossible." I said, "Yes, this is what ambient technology and AI technologies can do." So that's a work in progress right now. And that's just one recent example. But I thought it was fascinating that, I could present that to him and work with him on that program, to ultimately kind of return that time back to his team to really focus on other things that are really the humanistic side of medicine, not the process side or not the administrative side and so forth. So that's what we focus on. And it's really wide open. It's somebody saying, "Chris, we need this whole patient roadmap revamped. And we have a challenge because we're getting poor patient satisfaction surveys on this outpatient process. And I went into this to this hospital, and from beginning to end, within 10 minutes of a 4-hour meeting, I had a completely revamped a roadmap. And this was using three different artificial intelligence technologies, but it summarized meetings, it created coding, and then all the way to the flow chart. I mean, it was just wild what how fast something like that could, could occur. And I had a physician looking over my shoulder, and she said, "What did you just do?" I said, "Well, I have the roadmap here that you guys were looking for." And they just couldn't believe. They said that would have taken us weeks, if not a month, of meetings and summarizing and planning and everything else, and you did it in 10 minutes. I said, "Well, that's why I'm here." So those are just some quick examples, and those are everywhere. Those use cases are just everywhere. So, but I love them.
That's a really great story. I can identify with what you're saying, and we're going to delve deeper into why that works. But I just want to take a minute to talk about mid-career transitions. So, I attended the radiology conference, RSNA, and there actually was a whole session which I sat in on mid-career transitions. All these radiologists that were professors transitioning in the midpoint of their career to doing something in leadership. And then I also, while I was a professor at the University of Illinois, I attended a 3-day boot camp that was offered by Rush, which was like across the street from my office where at the University of Illinois. And it was a 3-day boot camp on mid-career transitions. There were 55 professors of medicine all across the nation sitting in on this boot camp about mid-career transitions. And you have beautifully made this mid-career transition. And I really admire what you've done. But I asked ChatGPT just for fun, why physicians transition in their mid-career from direct patient care to take on leadership roles. These are the things that came back from ChatGPT. I'm just going to read some of them, and then I want you to just grab onto the things that speak to you. So, one is a desire for a broader impact. Physicians realize they can influence healthcare more significantly by shaping policy or the hospital systems or medical education. So, burnout and work-life balance. The demands of patient care with long hours lead to administrative burdens, which you just talked about a minute ago, and that leadership roles help to with that. And that intellectual growth, seeking opportunities to solve problems. You mentioned you were looking for, more challenging things to do with healthcare. And then financial and career advancement, interested in policy and advocacy to influence healthcare policy, technological innovation, getting leadership roles in digital health and AI, which is what you're doing, or an entrepreneurial drive. So those are seven different reasons why a physician or a healthcare professional transitions into leadership. As I'm reading through those, you actually touched on all of those already, but I'd like to just have you comment, having heard what the ChatGPT thinks about all this.
I think that's a really good perspective, and I loved hearing that actually. And as you were reading them, I'm thinking yes and yes and yes and yes for my own journey. I think that as I one of the hospitals that I most recently worked for as a full-time clinical educator. When I stood up before, I think there was at the time roughly around 150 nurses, and this was an onboarding process that they had and so forth, and spoke. And it was to do with interprofessional communication. When somebody walks away from that, and I see the light bulbs in their heads, and they come up and they thank you and they say, "Oh, this helped tremendously. I was terrified of physicians, and now I know how to talk to them, and now I know how communication is best completed," and so forth. That I think is it's a telling time in a career when you're getting feedback from somebody saying, I like what you do and your message that you're sending. Please do more of that. And then I went on to do that for multiple conferences. And then I was asked again by a device company actually to go and speak on their behalf to drive their sales for medical devices. And so I went and spoke at this company's national conference. And at the national conference early last year, I had 5 to 6 people at least at that. And it was a pretty good size organization. It was an international company. They came up and said that was the best talk that they had heard since they've been with the company for 5 to 10 years. And again, that's the little signals that you receive mid-career or so, like, maybe I need to do this more. Maybe this is something I need to do. And that kind of shifted me in a different direction as well, right? Like pursuing that avenue. But I think burnout too, you mentioned burnout. That during COVID, I think we can all, I definitely don't want to talk about COVID for the rest of our lives because we've all talked about it and we all went through it. It was a time where burnout was probably the most discussed and the most concerning, and I saw it everywhere. I was overseeing an ICU, and I sat with four physicians on a daily basis, and it was a very challenging time, I think, for everybody's career, but especially in a medical ICU. And it nearly burned me out. And that's when I, again, it's one of those other indicators, like, what do I want to do with my career? What am I being called to do? The intellectual aspect that you mentioned as well. It's like, I just love being challenged, and I think I'm gonna live the rest of my life always being challenged, and I hope that continues. But there's a lot of draws, and I think I res you know what you had mentioned, I resonate with a lot of that. But it's following your calling, and my calling is always to, one was to master my profession and master my practice, and I felt like I did that. And then it was thinking, what is next? And that's returning that knowledge to a larger audience, like you mentioned as well. It's, I want to take what I've done and I've worked so hard for in my career and then share that. Where are my experiences? Where are my stories? What have I learned? Right? So that the next generation can come in, being empowered potentially by that knowledge, right? Like, they're going to take what they want from my experiences, but if I turn around and then going back to speaking before that large group of nurses, if they come out feeling better about their communication, that was a win. That's a big win. If that's empowering them and that next generation, that means we're adding back to medicine. And that's what I and then leadership as well. So yeah, I appreciate the physician's aspect of changing too from bedside to more administration or leadership and whatnot. And I can definitely relate.
Right. So I think most leaders in healthcare recognize that it's important to be knowledgeable about AI. In the last year, 2024, I did an AI executive education at Northwestern Kellogg, which is a school of management. Then I did an executive education in AI and healthcare at MIT. And then following that, I did a similar executive education, AI and healthcare at Harvard Medical School. And what was interesting, the first one I understand, it was business leaders. That was a business school, one of the best in the nation. But the other two were not business schools. And yet, the majority of people in those certification programs, I would say 75%, were not MDs. They were healthcare leaders. And to speak to the point that people who take these executive education programs are already healthcare leaders like yourself, but they all recognize that the future of healthcare is going to involve leading with artificial intelligence. And so I'm curious, how did you get involved with artificial intelligence in healthcare? What was the magic moment that that took off?
I that's a great question, and it's really kind of fascinating because I was introduced to AI, and it must have been ChatGPT, and I literally forgot what it was. The first initial kind of this is what it is was somebody using it to develop applications. And it was a friend of mine, and we were skiing together here in Colorado, and she was actively coding and doing all these. And I said, "What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm working with this new AI program and so forth and so on." And around that time, I was working on an educational program, really trying to streamline how education was rolled out at a hospital using QR coding, using online applications, all mobile devices. So when we had to initiate a process that was to a pretty large audience, I was tasked with creating this educational program, and everybody had to sign, and the competencies and so forth in a healthcare environment. And I did it using an online program. I QR coded everything, and the sharing of it and everything was so rapid and so quickly. So we're talking about technology here versus AI, but they're kind of at the same time occurring, and I was being exposed to that. I recognized how fast you could disseminate information and how easy it was using technology. So then when I see AI, and initially I was using it when I got exposed to it to look for resources and look for backing up what I was finding on the web and things like that. It was very rudimentary in a way. But I saw the potential because of how quickly it was creating protocols for me, how quickly it was writing pathways and policy. And I was on a committee for the American Association of Respiratory Care, and I was on the policy committee, or the, excuse me, the position statement. So we would write position statements, and we had to reconfigure them, check, for accuracy and update the references every 5 years. And so I was listening to them talk on my very first call. And as they were going through this document, reading it and editing and so forth, I opened ChatGPT and I said, "Here's what I'm trying to do." And I explained it in great detail. I prompted with the best knowledge that I had. And out came this beautiful document that was accurate, updated, and so forth. And I shared it with the committee. And they said, "When did you do this?" I said, "Just now." And they read the document, and I think they were just shocked. They were said, "How, what is," they didn't even know what ChatGPT was or AI, anything like that. And I said, "What do you all think?" And they said, "That is so beautifully well written. It is accurate." And then they asked, "Can you change this?" And I did it on the fly. And I think it floored everybody. And that's when I realized again, kind of reinforcing not only the technology aspect of it and what it can do, is the efficiency, the speed, and so forth. And I just remember somebody on the committee saying, "What do we tell the board about what the work we're doing now? Because now it's so fast." And now they've all been adopting it and trying it and using it and so forth. So I think that was a great introduction to kind of the utilization of large language models, essentially, and the real use cases of it. I mean, the educational build and whatnot, it supported, but that was more technology-based, using QR codes and whatnot. So I think that the augmentation that occurs with artificial intelligence is just, that's when I realized the value. I said, and then I was asked to give us a talk, and I was asked to speak at a conference after that because they said, "Chris, you're really diving into this." I was like, "I feel like a novice." They said, "Well, you know so much more than everybody." I felt like there was a little imposter syndrome going on. You're asking me to talk about artificial intelligence? Like, I'm new. They said, "Yeah, but you're so far ahead." So it was really a wild moment.
Well, exactly. I think many people outside of our circle of the AI and medicine space really don't feel that comfortable with it. Let me ask you this. The ambient listening systems that listen to the conversation in the patient room and generate the electronic record, kind of you were alluding to that, those have been adopted. I'll tell you, as of today, almost 50% of hospitals and health systems have implemented them fully. But there has been a big barrier to adopting not that AI in medicine, but the actual over 1,000 FDA-approved algorithms that are involved with actually caring for a patient. What are your thoughts on overcoming the barriers to implementation or adoption?
When I get to, I think it's a great question, and you're right. Ambient technologies are widespread, flowing everywhere. I mean, I can't think a week goes by where you don't read an announcement about a hospital adopting full-fledged ambient systems. And the physicians, the soft ROI that's being discussed is very telling. It's very positive. I love the positivity aspect of it. And hopefully we'll begin to measure that ROI, that fiscal ROI or financial ROI soon, because I think that's the new shift, I think, for 2025 is this is great. This looks amazing. We hear you. We understand it. We love it. And here locally at Denver Health, I think the gentleman that was kind of helping out with that project, he says that he has physicians coming up to him and hugging him. And he says, I've never implemented a technology and had people come up and hug me and thank me for doing so. And I think that's a real telltale sign of the overwhelming benefit of the ambient technologies. And so, but when we're looking at algorithms, and so that's obviously a lot more complicated because the risk. And that's one of the things too, is that a lot of hospital systems or even ambient company, or excuse me, artificial intelligent companies, we're talking about risk. And I always encourage healthcare leaders to go with the lowest risk first. So if we're looking at algorithms, depends on where those algorithms are being applied. If we're talking about direct patient impact, that's the highest risk that we can have. And so if we're looking at piloting different technologies or trying different technologies, I always start with something that's minimal risk, right? That doesn't necessarily impact patients directly. Now, clearly that could be the ultimate goal, but I believe that we should start with something lower risk. Now, where that takes place in a healthcare system, I don't know always. There's so many applications out there. I think the one of the reports that I shared was the VA, and I can't remember the title of it, but they're using over, I think it was close to 250 different AI applications in the Veterans Administration, in the VA healthcare system. That was pretty wild. And they show the use cases of it too. So you can see exactly where it's being used, how it's being used. I love that report because it was eye-opening. I thought, oh, it'll be 5 to 10 different systems. 250 or so, roughly, different systems out there. Clearly, they're going all in. And I love that. I mean, I didn't expect it. And I love that. But I think that change management is a career in a specialty for a reason. And whenever we're looking at, if you're healthcare administration or whatever, trying to implement an algorithm, you have to consider that whole field of change management because that's going to help you implement those changes. Yeah, I mean, it's hard just to roll out with something without resistance and concerns and fears and unknown. And so I think that incorporating good change managers and good communication can certainly help anytime you're discussing potential new algorithms out there.
Now, many have said that building trust is really key to all of this. How do you recommend building trust amongst the clinicians who would be using AI for patient care?
There's a gentleman out there, Chris McKay, and he's just a neat guy, and I communicate with him every once in a while, and we comment on each other's LinkedIn articles and so forth. And he has a company called Imaginative. I want to make sure I say that right. But he focuses on AI literacy, and he also does LinkedIn learning courses and things like that. But AI literacy is super important. And what it's not just about reading or anything like that. It's about understanding the technology. And so I think that if you're talking about bedside clinicians to administrators and everybody in between. I mean, the healthcare system has 200 plus different fields in it at any given moment. Making sure that people understand and communicating really, really well about what it can do. Because right now, again, like you mentioned, you and I are in that bubble of AI, and we know the people, and we share with the people, and we talk to the people, and we're surrounded by it. But we always forget that there's an enormous percentage of the population that reads the big headlines, right? They read the big headlines saying AI beat a physician in diagnostic capabilities. And it's like, oh my goodness me, no. But a lot of the general population feels that AI is a thing in the future. It's not here. It won't impact them and so forth. So when you begin that AI literacy training, it really opens up the opportunity to answer questions. I think that's a big key is, will this affect my job? Will this affect my day? Is it going to take my job? Things of that nature. And so opening up courses for AI literacy, I think, is hands down probably one of the most effective tools before implementation occurs and whatnot, and eliminates a lot of the fear that is occurring with AI. Because goodness me, I can't believe how many movies are out there right now where AI has taken over a family or taken over something, and Netflix and whatnot are definitely taking full advantage of the AI technologies right now, incorporating it. But it does generate more fear. And I think that there's a lot of fear out there. So first and foremost is overcoming fear, increasing knowledge, and increasing AI literacy is super important.
Oh, I love that answer because I found the same thing that when I speak to doctors at hospitals who maybe don't know a whole lot about AI, maybe in a grand rounds format, I find that there's, like you said, at the end when you people ask questions, there is a lot of fear. And what's clear to me, and you stated it really beautifully, is educating physicians is the key to eliminating the fear of AI, hands down. So I love that you came to the same independent conclusion. That is fabulous. I mean, on the education side, there most universities now, the major ones, have some type of executive education for healthcare leaders to take to address what you talked about. And like I mentioned earlier, I've taken three of them in 1 year. So I think that's a good way for healthcare leaders to very quickly, get familiar with the higher level discussion of AI. But, people who are in the C-suite of hospitals, this is a complex decision for them to have to pick which of over 1,000 different algorithms, many of which do the same thing. They have to make their choices. Like you mentioned, the VA picked 200 out of 50 out of the 1,000. So what we've seen in 2024 is that most major health systems and their C-suite leadership have created a position now, which is called Chief AI Officer. Like you and I would be like, we could just step into that position like so easily, and the people that we know, the AI community, can all do that. So what is happening is that hospitals are quickly now creating this position and really trying hard to make sure that at every major medical center there's a chief AI officer. And I want to make that distinction, not just a chief information officer who deals with the EMR, but a chief AI officer. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do, and I think it's wonderful, first of all. And I've been meeting and connecting with a lot more of those chief AI officers, and their backgrounds are moderately diverse. One of the backgrounds that I see a lot of these folks having is in clinical, a clinical background, and whether it be a physician or a PA or NP or whatever it may be. And I love that tie to the patient outcomes from these folks. So it's not just tech backgrounds, right? It's just not computer science like a lot of the CIOs and so forth. It's really that whole spectrum. It's realizing technology and patients, right? And it's really connecting those dots. So I think those are wonderful additions to healthcare systems in general. And the specifically, those roles are really good because I think it gives an opportunity to evaluate the various AI opportunities that are out there. And that's what a lot of hospital systems are starting to build now. We're starting to see those, is whether it's small teams from diverse backgrounds and so forth, really to analyze, because everybody's getting inundated with different technologies. I mean, it's just amazing how fast and rapid they're coming out. Every day, there's a major announcement, and it seems groundbreaking, but then tomorrow there's going to be another one. So how hospitals evaluate those different programs and processes and whatnot is super important. And I think that's an opportunity for a chief AI officer to create and construct a team that uses analytical, capabilities to really say, okay, we hear the technology, we hear you as a company if they're being pitched to buy that technology. Let's evaluate it. What's the way to evaluate that technology? Because right now, it's just, that sounds great. I love your white papers. Let's go with it. Instead, taking a step back and saying, all right, we have 10 companies out here we can go with, or 100 companies we can go with for XYZ solution. How do we evaluate those? And that's what's, I think, currently in the works. By the end of the year, I suspect we have a lot more rigid framework for that too. And I think that there's going to be a lot more hospitals publishing exactly how they analyze and evaluate AI technologies all the way through the implementation spectrum. And so I'm really excited to see who really starts to say, this is what we've done. And it's going to, I wouldn't say it's going to slow processes down, but it's going to streamline how AI companies and technologies are measured. And I'm really excited to see kind of what comes out of all that.
Right. And so just to close the loop on that, there is an organization that I'm planning on joining, which is called CHAI, and it is started by like some Duke and Stanford faculty. And basically what is going to happen is the really well-known university hospital systems are all going to be collaborating their in through CHAI what they find when they test all of these products. And so it's instead of everybody being in a silo and trying to figure it out, the academic medicine world, which is my world, is going to all collaborate through this organization, share the information, and try to be very rigorous in the science of which is best for patient care. For just in the last minute or two, give us some Chris pearls if you want to be a great healthcare leader using AI, some takeaway pearls.
Oh goodness, let's see. So, just a quick note on CHAI too. I did see them and appreciate the efforts in that regard. I'm trying to keep a pulse on the developments. I've looked at some of the folks that have joined and whatnot. So I think that's a great opportunity. But going back to your question, so one is I think that it's okay to be fearful of technology. It's okay to be fearful of AI. Keep an open mind, I think, and realize that this is the future. AI is moving into everything we do, whether it's going to a fast food restaurant, to filing your taxes, to healthcare, to stock trading. It's in everything, and it's made its way in other major organization or other industries, way ahead of healthcare. So I think that being fearful is okay, and inviting people that are skeptics to the room, to the table, anytime you're implementing technology is a good thing, because you want full scale adoption from the proponents to the people that do not believe that it will work or impact anything they do. So invite the fearful people, invite the people that are skeptics, as well as the advocates. I think that remembering too that artificial intelligence is built by humans. And really, it's humans that are excelling because we're developing it, right? It's not a sentient being of any kind. Its capabilities and limitations are all human created to an extent, right? We're getting into deeper discussions on AI, but I think that also is the humanistic side is what the big focus is on. AI is mainly focused on taking away administrative capabilities, augmenting the human capability. Augmentation is probably one of my favorite words to use whenever I talk about AI. And I think it's always a good one to remember, is it's helping me become better. It's helping me drive change. It's helping me make better choices and so forth. So yeah, those are some of my just quick pearls, is that, in medicine, I would love for AI, and I hope it's the future of it, is to return the time back to when we can look at a patient and listen more intently and care more and remove a lot of the administrative processes. And I think that's the ultimate goal for AI in healthcare.
Chris, this has been such a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking and hitting on all the key points that someone would need to know to be a leader in healthcare using artificial intelligence. And thanks for supporting our organization, the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine. And Chris and I are going to be working on a project, just writing a paper that talks about the use of these ambient listening systems in healthcare. So, if you like what you heard today, look out for our publication on ambient listening systems. Our college is going to be launching a journal soon called the Journal of the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine. And hopefully, you'll see Chris's paper in our journal with its first volume one, number one. It's been great. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
If you enjoyed what you heard here today, consider becoming a member of our professional society by going to www.americancollegeaim.org and click join. Also, don't forget to save the dates. September 19th and 20th, 2025, we'll be having our first ever scientific session at McCormick Place right here in Chicago. Go to our website to register to attend the conference. We hope to see you all live in Chicago, and we look forward to having you tune in to our next podcast on Melvin Monday here on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.